Some of the more cautious among his friends advised him not to go to his father until he had learned clearly why he had banished his mother, for they feared it might add to the accusations against her. But the less thoughtful, more eager to see their homeland than mindful of Antipater's own interest, urged him to press on and not, by delay, give his father grounds for suspicion or his accusers an opening for even now. They said, if anything had stirred against him, it had happened during his absence. Surely no one would have dared it had he been present. It would be absurd, they said, to be deprived of manifest goods for the sake of unclear suspicions, and better to hand himself over to his father at once and secure the kingship that hung on him alone. He yielded to this advice, for it was his fate driving him on, and crossing over, he put in at Sebastos, the harbor of Caesarea. What met him there, against all expectation, was a great emptiness. Everyone turned aside, and no one dared approach him. He had always been hated equally by all, but now the hatred found the freedom to show itself, and many were turned away besides by fear of the king, since every city was already full of the rumor against Antipater, and Antipater alone was ignorant of what concerned him. No one had ever been escorted more splendidly when he sailed for Rome, nor received with less honor. He already sensed the disasters at home, but out of cunning he still concealed it, and though dead with fear within, he forced his face to look composed. There was no longer any flight, no slipping away from what surrounded him, and even there nothing certain about home was reported to him, for fear of the king's threats. Yet a brighter hope remained. Perhaps nothing had been discovered, or if something had, he might disguise it with shamelessness and cunning, the only provisions left for his survival. Fortified with these, then, he came to the palace without his friends, for they were insulted and shut out at the very first gate. Verus, the governor of Syria, happened to be inside. Antipater went into his father and, emboldened by his own audacity, drew near to embrace him. But Herod thrust out his hands and turned his head aside. "This too," he cried, "is a parricide's doing, wanting to embrace me when he stands accused of such crimes. Away, most impious of heads, do not touch me until you have cleared yourself of the charges. I grant you a court and a judge who has arrived just in time, Verus. Go now and prepare your defense for tomorrow. I give you that much time for your schemes." To this, unable to answer anything in his confusion, Antipater withdrew, and his mother and wife, coming to him, related to him all the proofs that had been brought forward. Then, recovering himself, he set about considering his defense. The next day the king gathered a council of his relatives and friends, and summoned Antipater's friends as well. He himself presided together with Verus, and ordered all the accusers brought in. Among those brought in were also some servants of Antipater's mother, arrested not long before, carrying a letter from her to her son, which read, "Since all those matters have been discovered by your father, do not come to him unless you can obtain some support from Caesar." When these had been brought in along with the others, Antipater entered, and falling face down before his father's feet, said, "I beg you, father, do not condemn me beforehand, but give me an unbiased hearing for my defense. I will prove myself innocent if you are willing." But Herod, shouting at him to be silent, said to Verus, "That you, Verus, and every righteous judge will condemn Antipater as utterly corrupt, I am certain. But I fear that you too may come to hate my own fortune, and judge me deserving of every calamity for having fathered such sons. Yet I ought all the more to be pitied for this, that I was so devoted a father to such wretched creatures. My earlier sons, when they were still young, I honored with royal rank, and besides their upbringing at Rome, made them friends of Caesar, and objects of envy to other kings, yet I found them plotting against me, and they are dead, mostly through Antipater's doing. For it was he, being young and my successor, for whom above all I was securing safety. But this vile beast, having gorged itself on my forbearance, could not endure me any longer, for he thought I had lived too long, and my old age weighed on him, and he could not bear to become king unless by killing his father. And rightly so, in his reckoning, since I had brought him back from the obscurity to which he had been cast down, and had set aside the sons born to me by a queen to declare him my successor. I confess to you, Verus, my own madness. I turned those sons against myself, cutting off their just hopes for Antipater's sake. And what benefit did I ever give them equal to what I gave him? To him, while I still lived, I all but yielded my authority, and openly named him successor to the throne in my will. I assigned him 50 talents in income of his own, I lavished my money on him without limit. And when he sailed for Rome just now, I gave him 300 talents, and out of my whole family, I commended him alone to Caesar as my savior. What did those other sons do so impious as Antipater? Or what proof was ever brought against them to match what convicts this one as a plotter? Yet the parricide has dared to speak, and hopes once more to cloak the truth with his tricks. Verus, you must be on your guard, I know the beast, and I foresee already the show of credibility to come, and the counterfeit lamentation. This is the one who once urged me, while Alexander still lived, to be on my guard and not trust my body to everyone. This is the one who used to escort me even to my bed, watching that no one lie in wait for me there. This is the keeper of my sleep and the provider of my peace of mind, the one who consoled my grief over those I had put to death and weighed the loyalty of my surviving sons, my shield, my bodyguard. When I recall, Verus, his cunning in each of these roles, and his hypocrisy, disbelief in my own survival comes over me, and I marvel at how I escaped so grave a plotter. But since some fiend is emptying my house and continually raising up my dearest ones against me, I will weep for my unjust fate and groan in private over my desolation. But no one who thirsts for my blood will escape, even if the proof should come to touch every one of my children. Saying this, he broke off, overcome by his own agitation, and signaled to Nicolaus, one of his friends, to present the proofs. Meanwhile, Antipater, raising his head, for he had remained thrown down before his father's feet, cried out, "You yourself, father, have made my defense for me. How can I be a parricide, when you yourself admit I have always been your guardian? You call my devotion a monstrous pretense and hypocrisy. How could a man so cunning in other things so foolish as not to realize that so great a defilement once contrived is not easy to hide even from men, let alone from the judge in heaven, who cannot be evaded, who watches over everything and is present everywhere? Or did I not know the fate of my brothers, whom God pursued in this way for their scheming against you? What then provoked me against you? Hope of the kingdom, but I was already king. Suspicion of hatred, for was I not loved? Some other fear from you? No, it was you I was guarding, and for that I was feared by others. Want of money? And who had more license to spend than I? For if I had become the most depraved of all men and had the soul of a savage beast, father, I would not have been overcome by your kindnesses. You who brought me back, as you yourself said, preferred me above so many children, and declared me king while you still lived, and by the very excess of your other favors made me an object of envy. Wretched me, for that bitter journey abroad, how much time I gave to envy, how long a reprieve to those plotting against me. Yet it was for you, father, and for your struggles that I went abroad, so that Silius might not despise your old age. Rome is my witness to my devotion, and Caesar, guardian of the world, who often called me a lover of my father. Take, father, the letters from him. These are more trustworthy than the slanders spoken here. These are my only defense. By these tokens I prove my affection for you. Remember that I did not sail willingly, knowing the hostility toward me lurking within the kingdom. You, father, destroyed me against your own will, forcing me to give envy its opportunity for slander. I stand ready for the proofs. I stand ready, though I have suffered nothing anywhere on land or sea, I who am called a patricide. But do not yet love me for that. I have already been condemned, both before God and before you, father. And condemned as I am, I beg you not to trust the tortures of others. Let the fire be brought against me instead. Let the instruments pass through my own entrails. Let no cry of pity spare this vile body. For if I am truly a patricide, I ought not to die without torture. Such were his words, cried out amid lament and tears, and they moved everyone else, even Verus, to pity. Only Herod's rage kept him from tears, for he knew the charges to be true. At this point, Nicolaus, at the king's command, after saying much beforehand against Antipater's villainy and pouring out the pity due him, delivered a bitter accusation, laying upon him all the crimes committed throughout the kingdom, but above all the murder of his brothers, showing that they had perished through his slanders. He said that Antipater had also been plotting against those who survived, as rivals to the succession, for the man who had prepared poison for his own father would hardly have spared his brothers. Coming then to the proof of the poisoning, he produced the depositions in order, and railed bitterly concerning Pheroras, that Antipater had made him too a fratricide, and by corrupting those dearest to the king had filled his whole house with pollution. Having said much else besides and demonstrated it, he ended his speech. Verus then ordered Antipater to defend himself, but he said nothing more than that God was his witness that he had done no wrong and lay there in silence. Verus, asking for the poison, gave it to one of the prisoners condemned to death to drink. When the man died at once, Verus, having kept his private conversations with Herod confidential, and having written to Caesar about the proceedings of the council, departed after a single day. The king put Antipater in chains and sent men to Caesar to report the calamity. After this, Antipater was found to have been plotting against Salome as well, for one of Antiphilus's servants arrived bearing letters from Rome from Livia's maidservant named Acme. In them, she had written to the king that she had found among Livia's papers letters from Salome, and that she was sending them to him secretly out of goodwill. Salome's letters contained the bitterest abuse of the king and the gravest accusations. Antipater had forged these letters, and having corrupted Acme, had persuaded her to send them to Herod. But he was exposed by his own letter to her, for the woman had written back to him, "As you wished, I have written to your father in your name, and I sent those letters believing the king would not spare his sister once he read them. You would do well, once everything is settled, to remember what you promised." When this letter was discovered, along with the letters forged against Salome, a suspicion fell upon the king that the letters against Alexander too might have been forgeries, and he was overcome with grief at the thought that he had nearly killed his own sister because of Antipater. He no longer put off taking vengeance for it all. Though set on moving against Antipater, he was checked by a grave illness. But concerning Acme and the schemes contrived against Salome, he wrote to Caesar. He also asked for his will and rewrote it, now naming Antipas king and passing over the elder sons Archelaus and Philip, for Antipater had slandered them too. To Caesar, along with the customary gifts of money, he assigned 1,000 talents, to his wife, children, friends, and freedmen, about 500, and to everyone else he distributed no small part of his land and wealth. His sister Salome he honored with the most splendid gifts of all. These were the changes he made to his will. His illness advanced toward the worse, since his ailments had come upon him in old age together with despondency. He was by now nearly 70, and his spirit had been brought low by the calamities concerning his children, so that even in health he took no pleasure in anything sweet. What made the intensity of his illness still worse was that Antipater still lived, whom he meant, once recovered, to kill without delay. In the midst of these calamities, a popular uprising also arose against him. There were 2 teachers in the city thought especially exacting in their knowledge of the ancestral laws, and for this reason held in the greatest esteem by the whole nation, Judas, son of Sephorius, and another, Matthias, son of Margalus. Not a few of the young men attached themselves to them as they expounded the laws, and day after day the 2 men gathered around themselves what amounted to an army of the young. These men, learning that the king was sinking under his despondency, and his illness, spread word among their followers that now was the most fitting time to avenge God and tear down the works set up in defiance of the ancestral laws. For it was forbidden, they said, that there be in the temple any image, or bust, or work bearing the likeness of any living creature. Now the king had set up over the great gate a golden eagle, and it was this that the teachers now urged the young men to cut down, saying it was a noble thing, even if some danger should follow, to die for the ancestral law. For those who died in this way would have souls that remained immortal and a perception of good things that endured forever, while the base, ignorant of their own wisdom, loved life too much out of ignorance, and preferred a death from illness to a death through virtue. Together with their words, it was also rumored that the king was dying, so that the young men set about the undertaking with still greater boldness. At midday, then, with many people moving about the temple, they let themselves down from the roof on thick ropes and began cutting down the golden eagle with axes. Word of this was reported at once to the king's commander, who hurried up with a considerable force, arrested about 40 of the young men, and brought them down to the king. When he asked them first whether they had dared to cut down the golden eagle, they admitted it. When he asked next who had ordered it, they answered, "The ancestral law." And when he asked why they were so cheerful though about to be put to death, they said, as they were led off to be killed, that they would enjoy greater blessings after death. At this, the king, in his excess of rage overcoming even his illness, went out to an assembly, and after accusing the men at length as temple robbers who under pretext of the law were attempting something greater, he demanded to punish them beyond the ordinary penalty as impious men. The people, fearing that the inquiry might reach a great many, begged him to punish first those who had proposed the deed, then those caught carrying it out, and to let his anger toward the rest go no further. The king, with difficulty, was persuaded, and he burned alive those who had let themselves down from the roof, together with the two teachers, and handed the rest of those arrested over to his attendants to be killed. From that point, his whole body was overtaken by the disease, which divided itself among a variety of afflictions. The fever was not violent, but the itching over the whole surface of his skin was unbearable, and there were continuous pains in the bowels, swellings in the feet as of a man with dropsy, inflammation of the lower abdomen, and, worse still, a gangrene of the genitals that bred worms, together with labored, difficult breathing and convulsions in every limb, so that those given to prophecy declared his sicknesses a punishment for the teachers. Yet, wrestling with so many afflictions, he still clung to life, hoped for recovery, and devised remedies. Crossing the Jordan, he made use of the hot springs at Calairo, whose waters flow down into the Dead Sea and are sweet enough to drink. There the physicians decided to warm his whole body with hot oil, lowering him into a tub filled with it. He collapsed, and his eyes rolled back as though he were dead. When his attendants raised an outcry, he was revived by the sound. But from then on, having given up hope of recovery, he ordered 50 drachmas distributed to each of the soldiers, and large sums of money to his officers and friends. Returning to Jericho himself, he arrived already in the grip of melancholy, and, all but defying death itself, pressed on toward a monstrous scheme. Gathering the leading men from every village throughout all Judea, he ordered them shut up in the place called the Hippodrome. Then, summoning his sister Salome and her husband Alexis, he said, "I know the Jews will celebrate my death as a festival, but it is in my power to be mourned by other means and to have a splendid funeral if you are willing to carry out my orders. As soon as I breathe my last, have these guarded men killed at once, surrounding them with soldiers, so that all Judea and every household will weep for me, however unwillingly." Such were his instructions. Letters then arrived from the envoys in Rome, announcing that Acme had been put to death by Caesar's order, and that Antipater had been condemned to death, though they added that if his father preferred to banish him instead, Caesar would permit it. This lifted his spirits a little, but then, worn down by lack of food and a spasmodic cough, overcome by his pains, he resolved to anticipate his fate. Taking an apple, he asked for a small knife since he was in the habit of peeling it before eating. Then, looking around to see that no one was there to stop him, he raised his right hand as if to strike himself. But his cousin Aeschybus ran up and stopped him, seizing his hand. At once a great wailing rose through the palace, as though the king were dead, and Antipater, hearing it, quickly took heart and, overjoyed, begged his guards, with a bribe of money, to release him by loosening his chains. But the officer not only refused, but ran to the king and reported the plot. Herod cried out more violently than his illness allowed, and, sending his bodyguards at once, had Antipater killed. He ordered the body buried at Hyrcania, and once more revised his will, naming Archelaus, his eldest son, as successor, and Antipater's brother Antipas as tetrarch. 5 days after his son's execution, he died, having reigned 34 years from the time he overthrew Antigonus and took control of affairs, and 37 from the time the Romans declared him king. In every other respect, he had enjoyed good fortune, if any man ever did, who from a private citizen won a kingdom, and having kept it so long, left it to his own children. But in his household affairs, he was the most unfortunate of men. Before news of his death became known, Salome, going out with her husband, released the prisoners the king had ordered killed, telling them the king had changed his mind and was sending each of them home. Once they had gone, she and her husband then announced the death to the soldiers and gathered them, together with the rest of the people, into an assembly in the amphitheater at Jericho. There Ptolemy, entrusted with the king's signet ring, came forward, first pronounced the king blessed, then addressed the crowd, and read out the letter the king had left for the soldiers, in which he urged at length their loyalty to his successor. After the letter, he opened and read the codicils, in which Philip was made heir of Trachonitis and the neighboring territories, and to pass, as already said, tetrarch, and Archelaus declared king. To Archelaus, he had entrusted the task of carrying his own signet ring to Caesar, along with the sealed arrangements of the kingdom. For Caesar was to be the final authority over all his dispositions and the guarantor of his will, while everything else was to stand according to the earlier will. At once a shout went up from those rejoicing with Archelaus, and the soldiers, company by company, came forward with the people, promising their loyalty and praying also for God's blessing on him. After this, they turned to the burial of the king. Archelaus spared nothing in magnificence, bringing out the whole royal array to accompany the body in procession. The bier was of solid gold, studded with jewels, its coverlet of embroidered purple, and on it the body itself lay wrapped in purple. A diadem rested on the head, and above it a golden crown, with the scepter beside the right hand. Around the bier walked his sons and the multitude of his kinsmen, followed by the bodyguards and the Thracian company, the Germans and the Gauls, all arrayed as for war. Behind them marched the rest of the army, fully armed, following their commanders and captains in good order, and after them, 500 household servants and freedmen carrying spices. The body was carried 70 stadia to the Hierodium, where, in keeping with his instructions, it was buried. And such was the end of Herod's story.